This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a roundtable discussion of the top stories in the news. Now, from CBS News headquarters in New York, here is correspondent Bill Whitney.
The presidential campaign took some exciting twists and turns this past week as John McCain clobbered George W. Bush in New Hampshire and Gary Bauer bowed out. A plane crash off Southern California claimed 88 lives and raised questions about aircraft maintenance. In the face of international protest, Austria formed a new government that includes followers of a right-wing extremist. The Northern Ireland peace deal threatened to unravel. The CIA faced criticism for its handling of former director John Deutsch, who stored super-secret material on his home computer. Four white New York City police officers went on trial in the death of Amadou Diallo, the African immigrant who was fired at 41 times. The Federal Reserve made its move and raised interest rates while Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan was easily confirmed for another term. The St. Louis Rams won the Super Bowl and coach Dick Vermeil promptly retired. Joining us on the Weekend Roundup are CBS News correspondents Dan Revive, David Dow, Bob Orr, Kimberly Dozier, and David Martin, along with CBS News reporter Jim Krasula, reporter Ann Anderson in Vienna, Director of Surveys Kathleen Frankovic, our computer consultant Larry Maggot, CBS News legal consultant Andrew Cohen, WCBS reporter Irene Cornell, Stacy Tisdale of CBS Market Watch, and Dick Enberg of CBS Sports. First, politics. Dan Revive, you were in New Hampshire for the primary. What's your take?
Well, it was sure a big victory for John McCain. And I think it's worth mentioning that there were some in the media who'd been waiting for a day like that because McCain seems to have become a media darling in the last few months. It might be because George W. Bush was the front runner for so long. And, of course, naturally the news media want to have something new. So McCain, who's been around for a while, posed as the maverick and the outsider in New Hampshire. He persuaded many independents to show up and vote in the Republican primary and to vote for him. The results in New Hampshire, McCain 49%, Bush 31%, an 18-point gap is really something wide. And on the Democrat side, it also was striking because on that day, on Tuesday, a lot of Vice President Gore's supporters, many of them from out of state, many powerful people with high positions in the Democratic Party, were worried Gore might lose, maybe by just a little, but they really wanted him to win, and he did win by just 5 points. Gore 52%, Bill Bradley 47%. Bill.
So the spit out of the Gore camp can be that he won solidly in New Hampshire.
They say 5 points is enough, but I think you have to, in fact, see what they averted. They were really worried that Bradley would win, even by 1 or 2 points, and so the score would then be 1-1. Gore wins Iowa, Bradley wins New Hampshire. They did not want that. Now the score is 2-0. They like it.
But was New Hampshire sort of a must-win for Bradley?
No, it's Super Tuesday. That is that. More than a dozen primaries on March 7th. Bradley is fighting. He thinks he has a really good chance in New York. That's where he was a star on the New York Knicks, the basketball team. And, of course, he was a senator from the neighboring state, New Jersey. And he's working hard in California, too. And so, no, it's March 7th. And if you want to talk about, you know, maybe pressuring Bradley to quit the race, because believe me, some of Gore's people would love Bradley to quit the race, save them a lot of campaign money, for instance. If you want to talk about that, well, even the Gore people know you can't pressure Bradley to quit until after Super Tuesday, so that is the date that matters.
Now, McCain got a huge bounce out of New Hampshire. Campaign contributions came pouring in. I think in the first 48 hours, more than $1 million had been pledged to his campaign website. His finance director said he couldn't keep up with all the calls that were coming in from people who wanted to give money. And he shot up in the South Carolina polls. And I want to ask Kathleen Frankovic about that. What do you attribute that to?
Well, you know, if you look at the New Hampshire polls conducted in the 2 to 3 days after the Iowa caucuses, we found that Al Gore shot up dramatically after his caucus victory. So I think the changes in the South Carolina polls may be just the same thing happening. And obviously, by the time Tuesday rolled around, Al Gore's 20-point margin had slipped to just 5. So I think we have to treat the South Carolina polls with a grain of salt. Obviously, the McCain campaign is invigorated. People are starting to pay attention to him who weren't paying attention before. It makes things exciting. But we've still got 2 weeks to go.
What does this do for him in South Carolina? Bush had the Republican establishment in South Carolina solidly behind him. But that doesn't mean the Republican troops necessarily follow.
The interesting thing in New Hampshire was not only that John McCain brought in independents and late deciders into the process, but he actually won among registered Republicans. He beat George W. Bush there. The South Carolina primary is an open primary. All you need to do is say, oh, I'm a Republican today, to go vote. Even people who think of themselves as Democrats could actually show up. Clearly, John McCain needs to keep that outsider, that independent image going, and he needs to motivate people. If he does that, all bets are off for February 19th. But one point as well, there's something else in between. This coming Tuesday, Delaware is having a primary that's a closed primary, and believe it or not, Steve Forbes is still competing and spending money in Delaware.
There was one poll this week, the Zogby poll, which actually showed McCain ahead of...
I guess I would take the surveys now in South Carolina with a grain of salt. They show McCain very competitive with George Bush. The question is, what are they going to show a week from now after the New Hampshire bounce wears off?
Let's call on CBS News reporter Jim Krasula, who has been traveling with John McCain in South Carolina and joins us from Florence, South Carolina. Jim, what's the atmosphere like?
I'll tell you, Bill, we've seen a change certainly in the past few days from when he got into South Carolina from New Hampshire. McCain, there's a real electricity in many of his campaign stops. McCain says privately even he's surprised at how his message is being accepted here and the campaign has taken off. You were talking about the huge increase in campaign contributions this past week, especially over the internet. McCain certainly is buoyed by all of this. He says he's exuberant. And he feels, Bill, that his message, primarily of government reform, will play to a wide political spectrum. At an event in Myrtle Beach, he talked about the fact that several people came up to him and said, we're independent, we're Democrat, but we're going to vote for you. He says that reminds him of the old Reagan Democrats, and he says that that's part of what he's going to aim for here. He's also done a lot of talking campaign around the state here, dealing with the military issue. South Carolina has more veterans than any other state, and McCain knows that he's got to attract these veterans. He's talking a lot of military issues, improving VA hospitals, improving the pay and benefits. At most every campaign stop, he says, under my watch, there will be no food stamp army, talking about the fact that many people in the military qualify and, in fact, are on food stamps.
And one other development in the campaign this week, and that is that Gary Bauer dropped out after placing just 1% in the New Hampshire primary. Next up, the crash of Alaska Airlines Flight 261. And Alaska Airlines MD-83 was flying from Puerto Vallarta to San Francisco last Monday when the crew started having trouble with the horizontal stabilizer, the adjustable tail wing that's used to point the plane up or down. The pilots struggled for more than half an hour. They arranged an emergency landing in Los Angeles, but suddenly lost all control. The plane plunged into the Santa Barbara Channel and shattered. All 88 people aboard were killed. CBS News correspondent David Dow has been on this story all week. And David, a major part of this story is the human tragedy.
It has struck right at the heart, particularly of Ventura County, the county closest to the stretch of water that you spoke of where this accident took place. And almost immediately, as one piece of evidence of this, you had much of the fishing fleet of Ventura County out in the water, joining the search for survivors, for debris, for wreckage. In fact, helpful almost to a fault, to the point where finally the Coast Guard and Navy had to shoo them off in order to secure the debris area out there. You've had people arriving at the beaches, facing out to sea to the crash scene, leaving floral tributes, crosses, what have you, organizing memorial services, prayer services for the victims. I think part of the extreme outpouring has to do with a manifest, as they say in the aviation business, of this flight. You had whole families knocked out of the air, knocked out of existence. Six members of one family, five members of another, four members of two other families. This included a number of children, including three infants. So there was a lot to strike right at the heart of a community and at a human heart.
And a lot of these people had been on vacation. They'd gone down to Mexico to have some fun.
This was a happy time. people go to Puerto Vallarta to have fun. This was an outing. This is a time to go down and let loose and enjoy a place that has been celebrated in films. Night of the Iguanas, featuring Elizabeth Taylor, was done there and put the place on the map. And what you had basically was a plane full of people coming home from a very satisfying time in their lives, only to have it suddenly, abruptly snatched out in tragedy.
From everything I've heard, the scene on the water out there was very ugly.
Well, it's very ugly, particularly, I think particularly of one photograph that the Los Angeles Times photographer managed to get of a single shoe in the water. And you looked at that shoe, and it was hard to take your eyes off it because of what it symbolized and what it seemed to represent for the whole plane load of people.
Now, they have recovered the two black boxes. They found the tail section of the plane underwater. CBS News correspondent Bob Orr has been following the investigation. Bob, what's been learned so far?
Well, Bill, frankly, the investigators have a pretty good idea of what went wrong. The big question is, why did it go wrong? As you mentioned at the outset, the pilots of this plane were struggling with the horizontal stabilizer. That's that big wing-like device in the tail that helps to stable the plane, to level it out. It can be used, along with the elevators, to move the plane up and down. The pilots reported there was a runaway problem with that stabilizer. And what that means is that the panel, for some reason, moved all the way to its extreme position, putting tremendous pressure on the nose of the airplane in a downward way. The pilots were able to, as they say in the aviation business, trim the jet. That was regain control for 7 to 9 minutes, and then they continued to troubleshoot the problem with mechanics on the ground before they suddenly lost the control of the plane and it plunged from 17,000 feet. The cockpit tape makes it clear that the pilots tried just about everything, tried all the backup systems. They pulled circuit breakers. They flipped through the manuals. They consulted with mechanics. The question is, why weren't they able to maintain control once they arrested that runaway stabilizer in the first place? Why weren't they able to make an emergency landing? The flight data recorder, once they're able to analyze that, and that's going to take some time, might give us some answers to those questions.
I know it's way too early to jump to any conclusions, but is it possible that their efforts to troubleshoot the problem in the air may have contributed in some way to the crash?
Well, absolutely. And it's a hard thing for investigators to suggest because, after all, there are signs that these pilots tried valiantly to save the plane and all 88 people aboard. But the fact is, once the initial problem seemed to be solved for the moment, there are some investigators who say the prudent thing maybe would be to put the plane down right away instead of trying to fix the problem, instead of trying to troubleshoot. But it's way too early to suggest that these pilots even had a chance. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. The one thing that is certain is this is an extremely, extremely rare crash. I have looked through all of the databases that I know of. I cannot find another example of a runaway stabilizer trim causing a fatal jetliner crash. We're almost here in new territory in terms of aviation safety.
Now, they've listened to the cockpit voice recorder, and from what I understand, the entire 30-minute recording includes discussion of this problem, so we know for at least half an hour or so they struggled with this.
And that concerns investigators. Obviously, they did have control of that airplane for a long period of time. That begs the question then that you asked before. Well, if they had that much control, wouldn't it have been more prudent to put it on the ground and let the mechanics fix it eventually on the ground? There is some pressure in the aviation business not to make emergency landings unless you have to, not to divert the flight unless absolutely necessary. What we can take from this is perhaps the pilots didn't think it was as serious as it turned out to be at the onset, and then something else happened to make it unrecoverable. But these are the questions the investigators over time will try to answer.
You have to wonder what was going through the pilots' minds because, as you say, this is such a rare thing. They may have been taken very much by surprise.
Oh, I'm certain they were taken by surprise. I mean, you can picture yourself in the cockpit midway through the flight from Puerto Vallarta up to San Francisco. Everything's fine. You're at 31,000 feet in cruise altitude. That is, without doubt, the safest part of any flight. It's the part of the flight where the pilots routinely will use the autopilot and kind of kick back and not relax. They're always vigilant, but if there is a time to relax, that's it. Suddenly they notice something wrong with the horizontal stabilizer. It's moving when it shouldn't move. Perhaps they flipped off the autopilot. It may have disconnected on its own if the movement of the stabilizer became too erratic. And then they're very schooled in what to do. In that case, so you simply hit the brake switch. It turns off the electric motor to the stabilizer. You use the elevators to kind of offset the stabilizer effect, and you trim the plane out, and you go on. What happened next is really the focus of the probe, and that is, why after they were able to do that, did they then subsequently lose control of the airplane? And this is the period of time where they spent at least 15 minutes trying to troubleshoot the problem, in essence trying to fix the jammed stabilizer and looking through their manuals and talking to the mechanics. And we may never know whether or not they really had a chance to save the airplane, but I think the fact that they were able to arrest the initial problem suggests that maybe in the earliest moments they did have a chance.
Correspondent Bob Orr. When we come back, as the right wing rises in Austria, anxiety rises around the world, and the Northern Ireland peace plan in deep trouble. The United States, Israel, and the European Union expressed strong concern this past week as the Freedom Party, led by far-right politician Jörg Haider, joined a coalition government with the conservative People's Party in Austria. Reporter Ann Anderson joins us from Vienna. Ann, who is this man and why is the world so worried about him?
Jörg Haider is a right-wing populist. He is probably the most popular populist in Western Europe, and certainly the most successful. The reason many are concerned is that his movement here may encourage other far-right movements in the rest of Western Europe.
How did he get to where he is now?
He has been a politician of many different disciplines. He is conservative when he needs to be. He has been liberal when he needed to be. And he has won because he continued through his political life to campaign on the basis of attack and raising fears about foreigners and creating a xenophobic atmosphere in Austria. This is not a new style of campaigning for him. He has been successful in it since 1986, and he managed to get support away from the People's Party, which was the party of Kurt Waldheim, and he was also able to champion the causes of many disaffected laborers.
Haider is considered by some to be a Nazi sympathizer, and he has expressed approval of some of Hitler's policies. He has, in recent time, renounced some of those comments, but are people taking that renunciation seriously?
Heidi Schmidt, who was a member of the Freedom Party, went off and organized her own party, Liberal Forum. She has complained about Haider in the campaign that he does not take responsibility for his words or his actions, and all he wants is power. Other observers have said that Haider's style is to attack his opponents rather than compromise, and somehow he has been successful because this behavior has been excused. But on a national and an international level, now Haider may not be able to conduct himself the same way.
CBS News correspondent Dan Revive has monitored reaction in this country. Dan, how worried are the Clinton administration and, for that matter, the American Jewish community?
Well, in fact, it's two different fronts. Of course, the American Jews are concerned that anyone who has spoken approvingly of Adolf Hitler might come to power in Austria, and so Jewish groups are opposed to it, and they sent letters. Interestingly, one of those groups got a letter back from the president of Austria. President Kleistiel does not like Haider one bit, and yet he wrote that if I, the Austrian president, decided to dissolve parliament and call new elections, it would probably lead to Haider getting even more votes. Now, as for the U.S. government, it is concerned, and this is rare. It's really rare for the U.S. administration to intervene in the domestic affairs of any country, but I think Germany and Austria are real exceptions. If anyone who smacks of Hitlerism rises to power there, yes, even Washington speaks, and Defense Secretary William Cohen, for instance, talked about this perhaps being a step back into a very dark past. And the State Department was talking about the possible effects on democracy and tolerance in Europe. So it said that U.S. relations with Austria will be reviewed, keeping an eye on this governing coalition that includes the extreme right-winger. Bill?
Israel has withdrawn its ambassador. The European Union is threatening sanctions. But how much can the world community do to interfere or even meddle, shall we say, in the affairs of a democratic government?
It's always a very careful balance. If the outside world seems to meddle too much, then you get the supporters of this man and his party gathering around him, saying, hey, this is our whole point. This is why Austria is not a member of NATO, for instance, because we're feeling very nationalistic, and so you don't want to push too hard. That is what Austria's president was warning the U.S. Jews, the American Jews, about. Don't push too hard. It'll only help Haider, but the U.S. government wants to make clear that it stands with most of the European Union in saying that it's just not acceptable to have this kind of man in any position of power in Europe.
Dan Raviv, thank you. Now to Northern Ireland. Serious trouble with the Good Friday peace plan on the verge of collapse. Kimberly Dozier in London. Bring us up to speed on that.
We have another deadline next week when British rule may return to Northern Ireland. The Good Friday peace deal rested on one thing, disarmament. Now, the report has just come out from the disarmament committee. They've looked at all sides and said no major paramilitary group has even started to disarm. This is a process that's supposed to be done by early May. Because of this, the unionist politicians, the majority Protestant group, says it's going to pull out. And if it pulls out, that means the Catholic Protestant power sharing body dissolves. To head this off, the British government has stepped in. It's a legislative thing and said, no, don't pull out. What we'll do is suspend it. We'll freeze it in time, and Britain will take over again in Northern Ireland. Basically, we're turning back the clock 2 years to before the whole Good Friday peace deal began.
I can't imagine that the British government in any way wants to take over again in Northern Ireland.
No, and in many cases, in many senses, people in Northern Ireland will tell you they feel like the British government never left. That's one of the reasons that the IRA says it has not started its disarmament process. They say in areas where it has covert bases or a lot of activity, there's still a high level of British military and police activity monitoring them. So they're keeping their guns, and because they're keeping their guns, the Protestant paramilitary groups say, hey, we've got to stay protected too. Therefore, no one's taking that step of putting something on the table, except for the Protestant politicians who took the risk 2 months back and went into power and sat down at the table across from Sinn Féin politicians. That's the IRA political wing. They say, look, we jumped. Now it was your turn to jump. You didn't. You're back there on the ledge. We're still waiting. Now we're going to walk out.
Is this a game of chicken between Sinn Féin and London?
It is a bit, but it's a lot more serious this time. It looks like Sinn Féin simply can't deliver the goods. It can't get the IRA to start the disarmament process because a lot of Sinn Féin politicians point out they stuck their necks out as well. Everyone thought the disarmament process would be somewhat on its way by now, though Sinn Féin says no one ever promised it would be on its way by now. That was just they say that's a unionist ploy, that the Protestants were just trying to force them into the corner. The people of Northern Ireland, meanwhile, poll after poll, people are furious. They thought they had finally, had it made. They had their own government. And that a lot of this nonsense was in the past. Last 2 months ago when I was there, when the parties first sat down at the table together and I interviewed people, everyone was, they really wanted to hope. And at the end of every interview, people would say, but, you know, knowing how things go here, and it looks like we may soon be back at square one.
Kimberly Dozier in London. Up next, CIA secrets on a home PC, and the Diallo trial opens in New York. We learned some disturbing details this past week about the case of former CIA Director John Deutsch and the highly sensitive material he stored in his home computer. CBS News correspondent David Martin has been following this story. David, some background.
John Deutsch was director of the CIA in 1995 and 1996, and when he was leaving the job, the CIA security people conducted a routine check of his computers and found that three computers that were unclassified computers, one in his home in Bethesda, Maryland, one in his home in Massachusetts, and a third was a laptop that he used to carry about with him, all contained highly classified documents, and they were not cleared to have highly classified documents. They were about 235 pages in all of classified documents. They, some of them were memos to the President of the United States. They dealt with private conversations Deutsch had had with world leaders.
So really secret stuff.
This is very sensitive stuff. I guess the only good news in there is that there does not appear to have been any information that could get somebody working for the United States as a spy killed. In other words, there weren't any details of ongoing operations in there.
Now, it's apparent that Deutsch was not the only person who had access to these computers.
Yes. First place, there's the theoretical access. The computer, certainly the one in his Bethesda home, was used also to access the Internet. He did his banking online, for instance. And any computer that is hooked into the Internet obviously is capable of being hacked into. So it was vulnerable in that sense. Plus, somebody used the computer to access porn sites. Now, the computer makes a record of when that access is made, and the investigators looked at Deutsch's schedule and looked at the times the porn sites were accessed, and he was never there at any time the porn sites were accessed. The assumption is it was one of his children, whoever it was, somebody in his house, did not have the clearances to be reading memos to the president. Now, we don't know that they read the memos to the president, but they certainly could have.
And there was also some email from a scientist in Russia?
That appears to have been a one-way transaction. In other words, the scientist emailed Deutsch. Deutsch did not respond. But what that says to me is the Russians knew his email address, and I would think that would make it a fairly likely target for a Russian cyber attack.
Let's bring in CBS News computer consultant Larry Magid. Did Deutsch really compromise U.S. secrets, and should he have known better?
The odds are that nobody got into his computer, because as I understand it from the news reports, he was logged on through AOL. AOL won't confirm that because of their privacy policies. But I did speak with them, and you know, AOL itself, if you're on it, somebody can't just sort of reach in and read your files. There are, however, ways that hackers can plant what are essentially viruses or programs on your computer that make it theoretically possible. And I think it could have happened. I mean, it strikes me that it's just ridiculously silly to have secret documents of that nature on a computer that's connected to the Internet. I mean, even if the odds are relatively low, the consequences are so high, and the odds are not non-existent. I mean, there are hackers out there who, if they knew his Internet protocol address, theoretically could have gotten into it. So I can well understand why people were upset about this.
Thank you, Larry. In Albany, New York, more than 100 miles north of where the shooting took place, four white New York City police officers went on trial in the emotionally charged case of Amadou Diallo, a black immigrant who died in a hail of bullets. Irene Cornell of WCBS Radio has been covering the trial. She joins us now. First, Irene, a little background on the case.
Well, Bill, this happened in February 4th of 1999. Amadou Diallo, an unarmed African immigrant who works as a street vendor, had just gotten home from work. It was sometime after midnight. He was in the vestibule of his building. He had actually gone home, spoken to his roommate, and then gone out again. Now, the police story is that he was acting suspiciously. These were street crime officers on patrol. They're in plain clothes. They were hunting for a rapist who had attacked 52 women when they saw Amadou Diallo in his own vestibule, but they say he was acting suspiciously. He was coming out the door, looking down the block, ducking back inside, coming out again. The prosecutor so far has put on a bare-bones case of undisputed facts that Amadou Diallo was there in his own building, and he was shot down within a matter of under 10 seconds by 41 police bullets. A shocking, shocking case on the face of it. And the prosecutors have set out to prove that police did this with no warning, with no reason, and that they gave no word of warning to Amadou Diallo. No word like, stop, police, don't move.
Now, this case was moved out of New York City in the belief that the officers could not have gotten a fair trial within the city limits. They picked a jury. That was the first step in the trial. Tell us about the jurors.
Well, there are four blacks on this jury in the overwhelmingly white county of Albany. So all the concerns and shouts from the Reverend Al Sharpton, who has rallied and people around this case, were put to rest because they did get a large percentage of jurors considering the black makeup of that jury pool up there, which is quite minute. In fact, up there they're saying that you would never get as many as four blacks on an average jury, and they did this time around, four women. And it's ironic that three of the people on this jury have Bronx connections. The four women of the jury lived in the Bronx for 10 years in the same neighborhood where Amadou Diallo lived, and two other jurors are from the Bronx or regularly visit the Bronx. So you can take the trial out of the Bronx, but they didn't get the Bronx out of the trial.
CBS News legal consultant Andrew Cohen joins us. Andrew, what do the defense lawyers have to do to explain 41 gunshots in a matter of seconds?
Awfully tough to do, Bill. I think what you're going to see, though, is they're going to try to get jurors buying into this there but for the grace of God go I notion. They're going to hope that they can get jurors to understand what might have been going on in the minds of those police officers during those critical 4 seconds in order to establish that whatever they did was somehow reasonable at the time. You know, they're going to say to the jurors, look, obviously, in the light of everything, obviously looking back in retrospect, this looks awful, and it is awful. But put yourselves in the shoes of these cops. They didn't know exactly what was going on. Somebody yells gun. Even if they're mistaken, it doesn't make it a crime. It's going to be a tough case to show for the defense, but it's not out of the realm of possibility that you could get one juror buying into that. And, of course, if you get one juror buying into it, you get a hung jury and perhaps a mistrial. I wouldn't bet that that's going to be the result, but I wouldn't be shocked either.
Coming up, the week in business, and a Super Bowl winner goes out on top. It was a busy week for business and the economy. First, Federal Reserve policymakers did as expected and hiked key interest rates a quarter point. But a strange thing happened. Stacy Tisdale of CBS MarketWatch is here to explain. Stacy?
It was very interesting. What we saw happen was the government reduced debt by the largest amount in U.S. history. They reduced $17 billion in Treasury issuance. Without getting too technical, what that means is because we have a budget surplus, they don't need to borrow as much money. So they basically told the market that they're going to sell fewer Treasury securities. In a nutshell, what that does is push interest rates lower. Many of the rates that things we buy get priced off of, mortgage rates and everything, are going to move lower because of this move. So that's going to make the Fed's job of controlling the economy even tougher, because as houses and things like that are cheaper for us, it's going to keep the economy moving.
And that spurs inflation, and that means the Fed down the line, maybe even as early as next month, will raise rates again.
Many people on Wall Street had already been betting that the Fed was going to have to raise rates by a quarter of a percentage point. I mean, Alan Greenspan keeps trying to remind us that eventually the economy grows at this pace, demand is going to outstrip supply, and prices are going to go up. So to keep that from happening, he's raising rates to keep consumers from spending, keep consumers from borrowing, but now it's kind of a runaway train getting away from him, and all of the economic reports we see continue to show evidence of a strengthening economy.
Now, the Fed chairman himself got some good news this week.
He got his job back, and that's always good news for Wall Street, because even though everyone's trying to figure out the Fed dance of the moment, Alan Greenspan is perceived as being very good for the markets, genius when it comes to the economy, so most people out there do like that.
Now, there were four votes against him in the Senate, and those were primarily liberal senators who said that Greenspan is too worried about inflation, and he's over-exaggerating the impact of inflation, and he's not concerned about the impact interest rates have on the American household.
Now, that was interesting, because if you go way back when, the Federal Reserve's mantra, their whole mission statement is to prevent the economy from generating inflation. So, I mean, technically, they've had to take on such a bigger role because the economy has changed so much and grown so much, but technically, that's all they're really looking out for. So their job is to prevent inflation, and by doing that, they, you know, all the other pieces fall into place. So that's kind of an argument that some economists would say someone who doesn't know that much about economics would tell the Fed not to worry about inflation.
Some corporations made news this week. American Airlines came out with their new stretch out and take it easy coach class.
A passenger-friendly American Airlines, that is. What they're going to do is take two rows of seats out of each plane. That's going to give passengers in all classes about 3 extra inches in the front and in the back. And it's Americans making it like it's such a nice gesture. But this is really in response to all of the big outcries we've seen from consumers over the past year. And seat cramming is the number one complaint that consumers have against American Airlines. So that's really what they're responding to.
But the reason airlines have done that is to pack as many people into each plane and make as much money as they can. Now they're going to be losing some revenue.
Well, people are tired of being sardines. They could lose more revenues if consumers really, you know, step out against the airline.
Ford did an interesting thing this week.
I want to work there. Really, I want all these corporations out there to listen to this. Ford is going to get each one of its employees around the world computers for $5 a month. These computers have internet access, color printer, or the employees can pay $180. In an effort to have been good news for the workers, it's really an effort by Ford to increase worker productivity, which has been the driving force behind their success and the economy. It's going to keep their workers more in touch with what passengers want, consumers want. It's going to keep their workers more in touch with other workers around the globe. So this will really be a boon to productivity at Ford. And most of the analysts I've spoken to said you can expect Daimler, Chrysler, and GM to soon follow suit.
Did you watch the Super Bowl?
Of course I watched the Super Bowl.
Well, so did Dick Enberg of CBS Sports. And he joins us now to give us some perspective on the game. Dick?
Well, it was terrific, Bill. You can't ask for more than a fellow standing or lying close enough to the goal line that he can reach out and place the ball in the end zone and say, by that much, we would have been in overtime. And I think I would join the legion of millions of fans who watched a rather ordinary first half and an extraordinary second half that had hoped that he might get in the end zone and force the first ever Super Bowl overtime. I think the game was deserving of that and will go down as one of the truly exciting Super Bowls among the many that were so very disappointing. And it just shows what NFL parity has done. You know, you're rewarded for not playing well. You get higher draft picks. And then it was a very unusual year for the National Football League in that the teams that you expected to be in the Super Bowl at the very start of the year were hit horrendously with major injuries. And remember, Atlanta and Denver were in the Super Bowl a year ago, and those two teams would have been considered among the favorites to go again, and both suffered just penalizing injuries, plus the fact that Denver has the retirement of John Elway. And the other team, the New York Jets, was considered to be one of the top AFC teams, and they lose Vinny Testaverde before the season really gets going. The boys out in Nevada would have made that about 500-1 that Tennessee and the Rams would have met, but it certainly provided us with one of the great games.
What do you think they would have made the odds that Dick Vermeil would retire 2 days later?
Well, I would have made that short odds, actually. Knowing Dick Vermeil, you have to remember, again, those first 2 years coming out of broadcasting after, 13, 14 years and to the sidelines as an NFL head coach, and wasn't exactly the first pick of the Rams. He had two dismal seasons, losing years. Most of the fans in St. Louis were ready to send Dick Vermeil a first-class air ticket back to a broadcast booth. And I think it was one of the two great stories in the National Football League this year, the Kurt Warner story. If you had taken that quarterback's background and all the way to a Super Bowl MVP award, and a Hollywood scriptwriter had produced it, they would have laughed at him. They said that's just too far fetched. So Kurt Warner becomes what a wonderful young man and role model, and to see him succeed from the very depths of arena ball was one. And I think Dick Vermeil was the other great story in the NFL. You know, after 14 years away from the league, he was a former head coach at UCLA and an assistant coach. I remember him when I was a Rams broadcaster long, long ago. And then to have two terrible years in St. Louis, they wanted his hide. And then for him to be able to produce this Super Bowl championship team was just a fabulous story. And it wasn't going to get any better. No matter what he did next year or the year after, it wouldn't get any better than this year. What a perfect time to retire.
Thank you, Dick Enberg of CBS Sports. And that's our broadcast for this week. Special thanks to correspondents Dan Revive, David Dow, Bob Orr, Kimberly Dozier, and David Martin, along with CBS News reporter Jim Krasula, reporter Ann Anderson in Vienna, Director of Surveys Kathleen Frankovic, our computer consultant Larry Magid, CBS News legal consultant Andrew Cohen, WCBS reporter Irene Cornell, Stacy Tisdale of CBS Market Watch, and Dick Enberg of CBS Sports. I'm Bill Whitney, CBS News.
This has been the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Producers for the broadcast are Charles Kay and Michael Donahue. The associate producer is Michelle Cohen. The executive producer is Michael Friedman. This is the CBS Radio Network.